I try. Good evening, everyone. I'm Chris. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June 22nd, 2014. I have a sponsor, and I don't have any sponsees right now, but I'm always willing to sponsor. I've actually done my steps twice, one with my first sponsor, one with my second sponsor. So, all right, so I'm going to try and do this in as much of a chronological order as I can, but my brain has a tendency to do this whole jump around crazy thing, so we'll see how well that goes. But I'll try and stay on track as best I can. I did not grow up here in Kansas. I was actually born and raised here in Florida. I was actually born and raised in Kansas. There you go. See, I got you. Already going. I was born and raised in Kansas. I grew up in a little town, Manhattan, Kansas, college town. It's where K-State University is. Go Wildcats. But it's bleed purple. But I grew up there. My father was a pastor, has been my entire life, Free Methodist pastor. My mother was always pastor's wife. I'm the fourth of five kids. I got a little sister who's 4 years younger than me, and she's old enough to drink now, which is kind of crazy. And my siblings are all about four years apart, except for my older brother who's 17 months. And we definitely butted heads a lot. He stole all the tall jeans. I'm 5'6", 5'7". He's 6'2". So I always say he stole those because he beat me out, so he stole all the good jeans. Anyway, so I grew up, it's less than 50,000 people live in Manhattan, Kansas, so I always grew up kind of a small town kid. We lived on the edge of town, so it was not nowhere near the craziness and everything. I found out later on in life that if I had been a little bit older in Manhattan, I probably would have gotten into a lot more trouble than I did because there was everything you could think of available there. Found that out from my oldest brother, who has done just about everything under the sun. And he's an example because he's married with two kids and is clean and sober. Well, not sober. He drinks occasionally. He's one of those people that drank and drugged like an addict or an alcoholic, but somehow turned it all around. And I don't know. He got lucky, I guess. He's one of those lucky few. But I learned a lot from him, more so when he quit doing all the other stuff and discovered that he had a lot of life experiences that I definitely should have listened to earlier on in life. But anyway, early life, I was a weird kid. I was a nerdy, geeky kid. I'm good and cool, good in school, good in class, but I wasn't one of the cool kids. I'd help the popular kids with homework, and then I'd be shunned the rest of the time. So I was kind of bullied as a young kid, and that kind of started this idea in my head that I really didn't like me. I didn't like who I was from a very young age, from the time I was a very little kid. Like I said, I had a brother who was 17 months older than me, so I always felt like I had this grudge against him because I felt like my time with my mother and father was split between him and me. And then when he was old enough to kind of do his own thing and take care of himself, my little sister came along. So I felt like, I always felt cheated, you know, that little, you know, against your brother. It's like the weirdest thing. It's the stupidest thing in the world. But, you know, it's truth. That's what I felt like. I was cheated by my older brother and my younger sister. Like, I got cheated out of this attention, you know. Always wanted that attention. I never felt like I got it. That's just that alcoholic mindset. There's this craziness in my head, even from the time I was 4 or 5 years old. By the time I was 12, I didn't like me. I didn't like myself at all. I had two or three friends. Everybody else, I had tons of acquaintances, but it was really, I was only there when they needed something. Because I was smart, and so that they needed something, I was there to help them out, but that was about it. I wasn't special in any way, shape, or form there. So at 12 years old, I kind of made this decision that I didn't like being me and I was going to be somebody else. And I started to entertain this idea of being somebody else in my head. And I only mention that because it becomes more of a thing a little bit later on down the line. So I created this kind of alter persona at a very, like 12 years old, mind you. And I started creating this alter persona that I was going to, that later on in life became a big thing. So now we're going to get into the drinking part. That's kind of some backstory. So at 14 years old, I had my first drink. I was in Massachusetts for my aunt's wedding. And my cousins and nephews and everybody were there. And my cousins are all in their 20s at this time. They've all got a couple years on me. And they thought it would be really funny. Well, before that. So at the wedding, everybody gets married, you got the reception thing, and there's two different punch bowls, okay? One is made with champagne and other liquors, the other is not. I took the wrong one. I said, put that in quotations because I definitely knew which one was which. But the other one made me feel funny. I mean, I felt like good. I was comfortable. I was dancing around, talking with people, having a good time. And I hadn't felt that before. Like, I didn't like me. I was very uncomfortable with me. I'm uncomfortable right now. My heart is racing, and I'm probably talking a little quick. If I'm talking too quick, let me know, and I'll try and slow it down. But I get nervous in a group bigger than, like, four people. You know, I share at meetings, and I've spoken before, and before the meeting, my wife has to reach over and tap my leg because I'm shaking. Like, my leg is going, and by the time I get off stage, my hands will be shaking. But that's just me. I've always been nervous like that. And when I was drinking, I was gone. I was the life of the party. I could talk to anybody. It didn't matter who you were, what kind of situation I was in, what was going on in your life, my life. Didn't matter. Everything was A-okay. And Mike... So skipping ahead, my cousins noticed this, and they were like, wouldn't it be really fun if tonight we got Chris really drunk? So everybody leaves, the party's over, and they've got a pool table and dartboard and everything down in the basement, and my first real drink is vodka and Coke. Oh, it's terrible. Even later on in drinking, vodka was one that I still didn't like. I would drink anything under the sun. If it had an alcohol content, I'll drink it. That was like the saying from my friends. It's like, will Chris like this? Well, what is it? It's 100 proof. Oh yeah, he'll drink it. You'll be good. So I got blackout on my first night drinking at 14 years old. And then the next day we went to the beach with the family, and first hangover in the hot sun and salt water, not a good combination. Came back that night and did it all over again. So my first and second drunk were 2 days apart when I was 14 years old, and I got blackout both nights. And that is like the, in a snapshot, my drinking career. Blackout drunks, as wasted as I could possibly be, as often as I could possibly be it. Now, being 14, you can't just go out and get alcohol, and it's not that easy to attain alcohol. So I would drink when I could, because at this point I'm starting high school, and I made friends with the people who were the upperclassmen, the seniors, where I didn't get along well with people my own age. I always enjoyed hanging out with people, you know, 4 or 5 years or more older than I was. So I made friends with all those people, and when they'd throw a party, I'd come out and I'd be the weird kid in the corner until I had a couple drinks, and then I was the fun kid in the corner. Or in the middle of the room, or on the table, or, you know, wherever I ended up at by the end of the night. But, so, skipping ahead a little bit, I was the fourth of five kids. My dad was a pastor. My mother stayed home taking care of everybody. So, we grew up poor. We had everything we needed, but you never really had everything you wanted. Until I was about 9 years old is when I got my first job as a delivering papers on a paper route. And then I started paying for stuff I wanted myself. And then I've had a job. The longest time I've been unemployed since then was for a month. And it was between two jobs. I thought I was going to go crazy. I was going to either kill somebody or something was going to happen. I was going nuts. Because I'd been working for most of my life at that point. And so anyway, 16, I got a job working at Taco Bell. And everyone I worked with was either an ex-con, an ex-felon, or on felony probation. Everybody that I worked with. Except for me and like two other people, because we were all in high school. So we hadn't really done enough to get there yet. So basically I discovered that making friends with those people, I could get anything. And I did. I remember I worked the closing shifts on Friday, Saturday, and Taco Bell closes at 4 a.m. So we would leave, this is at 16 years old, and so I would leave there at like 5 o'clock in the morning, and instead of going home, because everybody at my house is asleep by now, I'm like, I'm going to go party after work. This is at 16, I'm going out with these people who I probably shouldn't be hanging out with at 16 years old, definitely not great influences, I'll tell you what. And getting wasted and waking up the next morning with 20 missed phone calls and messages from my parents, like freaking out because I didn't come home that night and nobody knows where I am. I'm like, oh, sorry, we closed late and buddy gave me a ride to such and such house and I just slept over there and I was really tired. You know, I came up with some kind of lie. I don't know how I never got in trouble for this, I don't know if it was just, I have no idea. Like, I never got caught or never got told I was caught by my parents. I never got reprimanded by them. But I continued to do this from 16, 17. And then when I was 17, I discovered that the guy who I was selling weed for at the time was, I started selling weed to make up some extra money on the side. I was smoking it, selling it, drinking, popping pills when I got the opportunity. But drugs were never really a big thing for me. It was more of an experimental thing whenever, you know, if it was available, yeah, I'll try it. Does it say don't take with alcohol? Yeah, give it to me. So that was like the criteria. But at 17, I was almost 18, probably a month or two from turning 18, I discovered that the guy who I was selling weed for was smoking meth while I was at work, and that kind of freaked me out, you know? The whole hanging out in places with all sorts of manner of things on the table every time you walk in, apparatuses and alcohol and drug paraphernalia all over the tables, and that didn't bother me, but helping the guy take out the trash when he drops a rock, and then, yeah, that bothered me for some reason. So I quit that job very abruptly, and then I started working as a delivery driver for a Pizza Hut, and that's where the fun started. Because when you work as a delivery driver in Topeka, Kansas, it's not the nicest town in the world. So people will tip you with, hey, you want to smoke? Hey, you want a beer for the road? Hey, do you want to take a shot? Oh, hell yeah, I want to take a shot. I remember a St. Patrick's Day when I was 19, I think it was. Yeah, no, I was still 18. I was 18, St. Patrick's Day. And the last I had taken, I mean, I was drinking from the time I got to work till the time I left. Because everywhere I went, it's St. Patrick's Day. You want a shot? You want a beer? You want everything? The whole day while I'm driving this whole time, mind you. So I'm delivery driving pizzas. And I'd show up to the house, here's your pizza. Okay, here's your tip. You want a shot? Yeah. All the time. All day long. Then the end of the day comes, the last house I deliver to pours me a Crown and Coke that there's about this much Crown in the bottom of the cup, and the cup's about this big around. And I drank that on the way back to work. My boss had picked up 2 pints of 100 proof peppermint schnapps, and one apiece, mind you. So we closed down the store while drinking this, because I was the closing driver. I always worked late shifts, because I was a night owl. Did not like mornings, but I loved being up all night. Like, that was my time. I've never been a fan of the sun, so still not so much. But so 100 proof peppermint schnapps between the two of us. And I drank a whole one myself. She drank a whole one herself. And this is after drinking all day while delivery driving. And then she's got a half bottle of Bacardi vodka in the back of her car. So we drank that. And then I drive home like this, back and forth between the eyes. And the crazy thing about this is I remember the next day, my mom knocking on my door, opening the door up, and she looks over and she goes, were you drinking last night? I'm like, I might have had a couple. She's like, well, I can smell it from the doorway, from like the front door, not the door to my room, but like it left a trail that she could follow from the front door to my room. And it's just, I just reeked of it. I was just everywhere. And that's just one story. I mean, it just got crazier and crazier the longer I went, because then I moved to Kansas City and I moved into an apartment with my brother Lewis, the older brother I had mentioned earlier. And we definitely were terrible influences on each other. We'd go drink for drink until he passed out, and then I'd just finish whatever was left. It got to the point where I was a daily drinker by the time I was 18. Like, every day. Not all day, because I could always pull myself together to go to work, and I could keep the shakes under control until I got home, where I could drink. After a while, drinking with him and hanging out with his buddies and drinking out. I had a buddy who he lived on his grandparents' land, and they had 60 acres, and we'd go out there and just go crazy. I mean, anything you could think of happened out there. I mean, hot tub, fun stuff, bonfires, lots of alcohol, blackouts. Woke up with my feet in the coals because I was cold in the middle of the night. And I guess in a blackout, got myself into a chair and slid as close to the fire as I could. And I woke up where I had smoke rolling around my ankles because my jeans were on fire and my shoes were melted. That was a fun morning because it was like 4 o'clock in the morning and everybody else had ditched in the middle of the night because it was cold and they'd all gotten up and left because, you know, they were all so still coherent enough to walk back to the house, which was a good mile away from where I was. So then I stumbled through the grass and, still drunk, back to the house and bang on the window and my uncle, because I drank with my uncle too, because he's a fun influence as well. Knocked on the door, he opens the door, he's passed out on the couch. I pass out on the floor next to the couch, wake up a couple hours later, and then go to work. So after, I'm just going to have to shore this up as quick as I can. So after a while, I ended up living in the entryway of my friend's house, where literally had the front door, the kitchen, and my bed. And I paid $200 a month. I was working three jobs. I was working a retail job, delivering pizzas, and I was doing construction with my uncle, and that was all under the table untaxed. And so I was making more money than I'd ever made, and I was just as broke as I ever was. And the only bill I had was my rent, which was $200 a month, and my phone bill, which was $100 a month. And the rest of it went to my alcohol. I mean, I would buy what I wanted in whatever quantity I wanted, and it was never enough. I would get off work at 6 o'clock, drive back to my friend's house, pick up a bottle or two on the way home, drink until 4 o'clock in the morning, pass out, and then be up at 8 o'clock to drive to work the next morning. And I would drive to work in and out of blackout on a regular basis. I delivered pizzas to a school for school lunches, and I remember in and out of blackout the way there. I remember loading the car, and the next thing I remember is opening the door to the school. I drove to the school with about 100, 150 pizzas in my car in a complete blackout. No idea how I got there. And there's a lot of turns on that road. So that wasn't even my bottom. My bottom came, I got a job offer, because I joined the military at 17 as a reservist for about 5 years. And I was a reservist for 5 years, and then I was to the point where being a reservist and doing it 1 week in a month was interfering with my drinking, because I was terrified to drink on the weekends, because my first sergeant knew that I'd found out that I had been drinking one night before when I woke up, passed out at 4, woke up at 6, drove to the in uniform to the drill hall, and I was definitely still wasted because I had drank an entire fifth myself the night before. And I was terrified of getting in trouble with the military for drinking and anything like that. So I basically was like, I'll hold it together on that 1 weekend a month. But it was getting to the point where that was just, I couldn't do that. It's like, I'm either going to do this military thing full time, which is a great idea, or I'm not going to do it at all. So I got offered a position down here in Tampa, and I took it, and I came down here, and I kind of white-knuckled it for the first month I was here. I was like, I can have just a little bit. I can drink just a little bit. But every day it just steadily got to where I was drinking more and more and more. And I went on a mission up to Morehead City, North Carolina. And we were buying a six-pack for three people, so I was only having two every night. And it was just you know, tense. And just barely holding on with that at this point. And the last night we're out there, like, we finished the mission a day early. They're like, hey, you can go. We're going to go out and we're going to bar hop tonight. And I was like, okay, sweet, awesome. So my thought is, they don't drink like I do, so I'm going to go 2 or 3 hours before we go out and just get myself ready. And I don't know the meaning of a single. Everything's a double or more. So, like, I used to do a rum and coke. It's like just enough coke to change the color. Just a little splash. That's all I wanted in there. And so I was plenty wasted before I caught up with them, and then I went through that entire night in a blackout. Found out later that I got in a fist fight with a 6'4", 270-pound sergeant. At the time, I'm an E4, so he outranked me. Got in a fight in a bar with a couple Marines. Had a Marine medic's girlfriend trying to calm me down that I karate chopped across the chest at some point. Almost got everybody I was with arrested. Got thrown into the back of a truck when the cops showed up. And somehow my sergeant was able to convince them that, hey, he's going to be fine. So-and-so hasn't drank that much. And I don't know how this happened, but my entire career of drinking, I never got a DUI. I never got arrested. I've never even been in handcuffs. Closest I ever got was a couple buddies walking around Lawrence, Kansas. It's a party town, by the way. And we're all walking around with open containers drinking. I polished my beer off. It's the only one I have right now because my other beers are in my buddy's backpack. Toss the can, turn the corner. There's a cop sitting right there, and everybody else I'm with has an open container. They're all sitting on the grass in handcuffs, and I'm standing there going, I don't know what I'm supposed to do right now, but I'm just going to stand here. So I don't know. I got lucky, very, very lucky, because it could have been a lot worse, because I drove drunk more often than I drove sober. And that thought kind of scares me every once in a while when I think about it, that it could have been a lot worse. I could have killed somebody. I could have killed myself. I could have seriously injured somebody. Lost my train of thought. Oh, yes, North Carolina. Thank you, James. So anyway, wake up the next morning, black eye, body hurts, head hurts. Sergeant won't talk to me. Nobody will look me in the eye. Make my way back here to Florida, and we get to the airport, and I buy breakfast, and I have a double whiskey with breakfast. Like, not even on the rocks, just in a glass. And my sergeant's like, starting early today, huh? And I made up some stupid excuse while I was having a drink, you know, a hangover or something. Something that sounded okay in my head at the time. But that was the only thing he said to me for the next, like, 3 days. He wouldn't talk to me on the plane, wouldn't talk to me at the airport when we got there. Like, nothing. And this is because, I found out later, this is because I didn't remember anything. But he remembers all of it. He was there for the entire thing. And he knows how bad it was. And the count, by my count of what I had before and their count of what I had after, is somewhere around 30-some-odd drinks. And for a guy my size at the time, I was 140 pounds. And then, of course, after this, I got told, I went to the hospital on MacDill Air Force Base, voluntarily, actually, pseudo-voluntarily. They basically said, you could do this, or we can find somewhere else for you to work. And I kind of did not want to lose my military job, because I loved it. I would be honest. I loved doing this full time. I loved doing the military thing full time. It's a gift for me. I mean, because I definitely almost screwed this up at the very beginning. I was barely in the job a month, and I almost lost it. So they took me in there, and you'd answer all these questions. And, of course, I lied. I made everything a lot less than what it actually was, and they asked quantities you drink and how often you drink. And they still told me I was a crazy alcoholic. I mean, come on. It's like, you mean 9 drinks is still too many? It's like, well, I was drinking way more than that. But real quick on a caveat, that sergeant, I really do owe my life, because he's the reason I went in there and even accepted getting help, because another one had said that I was gonna, that they'll get rid of me, and he told me, look, we're not gonna get rid of you. This is the first time this has happened. We will make this okay, but if it ever happens again, there's gonna be an issue. He's like, is this a regular problem, or is this something that is new? And I had to be honest with him. I have no idea why I was honest with him. Because I had that, my last drink was the day after I got back from the airport. I had 2 or 3 beers in my fridge. I polished those off, and then I laid in my bed in depression and shakes and sweats and craziness going through my head and the squirrel cage rolling, and I was crawling out of my skin. I was going nuts. I just didn't know what to do. And then I went back to work, and I hadn't, but when he brought this to me, I hadn't drank in about a day or so, and just a moment of clarity or something. And I was honest with him about, this is not new. This is a regular occurrence for me. And he's like, do you want help? I'm like, yeah, I guess so. What was I thinking? Yeah, I want help. So they evaluated me, and they told me, you're going to go into a locked ward for 28 days. And I was like, can I do outpatient? No. You can't do outpatient. So they put me in a locked ward, and I went through, and I saw therapists, and I have a terrifying fear of therapists, by the way, which stems back to the idea that I, from a very young age where I started working for myself, that I can take care of everything myself. I don't need somebody's help. I'll be good. I can take care of it. That was not the truth, because my idea of taking care of it was drinking. It made everything better. I mean, it didn't matter the situation. Does the day end in Y? Yes, I'm going to drink. I mean, it doesn't matter what happened, I was going to drink. It was just the way it was, and that's the way it ended up being for a good several years. So I ended up in this treatment center, and the last day of the treatment center, they're like, you've successfully graduated the program, congratulations. We suggest you go to an AA meeting. I did not want to go to an AA meeting. I had tickets to Warped Tour, which was on the same day as the day I got out. And you know what happens at Warped Tour, because it's a festival thing. Festivals, I've been to festivals. I went to a four-day festival in Alabama, and it started out on Tequila Thursday, and then every morning was tequila mornings, every day. Grain alcohol out of water bottles, because it looks like water. You can sneak it into the actual place, and you don't have to pay money for their alcohol. You can pay, drink what you brought with you. Did all sorts of crazy stuff. So I know what festivals are like. And I just like, this sounds like fun. I really want to do this. But at the same time, they're saying I should go to this AA meeting thing, work these 12 steps and get a sponsor and do stuff to better my life. That was a crazy idea to me at the time because I was still nuts. I'm still nuts. I'm still nuts now. Ask my wife. I'm crazy. So I ended up going to an AA meeting. This one, actually, was my first meeting. This is actually still my home group. So I came in here and I met Mark. He was the first person in AA who ever talked to me. I don't know why, but he did. I think I must have looked scared and out of place or something, because I'm sure I looked like a crazy person. But I ended up going out to fellowship with them and I met my first sponsor there, who very vigorously took me through the steps, and I learned a lot of good things from him. Like, he taught me a lot of the things that I still use today, like suit up and show up, you know, be present in AA. He got me into my first big service commitment, which was I did Ficky Paw my first year. I was the Serenity Chair. It's a great job for somebody with less than 6 months. Because your job is to keep all the people with a lot more time than you calm. And that's not fun. Yeah, but it was good. It was an experience. I learned a lot in that about AA, and I like I said, I worked my steps very as quickly, but I needed it quickly because I get distracted very easily. So, shiny thing. So he had to take me through it quickly. I had to go through it quickly. And I remember my fourth step. I almost lost my sponsor when I got to my fourth step. Because I was definitely dragging my feet. It's like, I don't know, I don't want to apologize to anybody. I don't want to tell anybody I fucked up. It's like, I know I fucked up, but I don't want to tell anybody I fucked up. It's like, those people are all back in Kansas except for the people at my job here because I was only here a month. It's like, how many amends can I have for a month? Apparently a lot. So, he pushed me through them, and he basically told me that if I didn't have it done by this date, I needed to find a new sponsor. But I really liked him as my sponsor, you know? So I didn't want to do that. So I sat down one night, and I just chugged away at it and got it done, and I went through that, and bearing my soul to him about all the messed up stuff I did over many years, I was a manipulator. I had these intricate lies, okay? So we're all liars. Everybody, we're all liars. It's part of our nature as an alcoholic. But I would create lies that the only people who could disprove it was me, in such a way that the only other people who were there at the time where this lie was taking place, like, the best way for me to describe it is I created these lies that were so intricate that you couldn't tell me it was wrong because, one, I believed it myself. I discovered that I lied to myself better than I lie to anybody else. I can convince this thing right here of anything. And once I convince myself that it's true, the truth becomes the lie. And that stems back to that whole altered persona that I created. It became that when I was drinking, it became a flip of a coin. Either he was going to come out or I was going to come out. I was a happy, fun-loving drunk. He was, I'm going to kill somebody drunk. He was anger and hatred and everything, because those were emotions that I couldn't deal with as an adult or even as a kid. So I would put them in his box. And then my box had all the fun stuff. And then his box had all the stuff I didn't like. And he became this twisted version of myself. And that's one of the gifts I got in sobriety, is that box doesn't even exist anymore. I deal with all emotions the way that I'm supposed to, the way as a person is supposed to, like a normal human being does. I don't drink over it, I don't go crazy about it. The good, the bad, I've lost four people that I was close to in sobriety. I've lost two grandparents, a sister-in-law, and a grandfather-in-law have all all in sobriety. And the first one was I was 9 months sober when I lost my grandmother. And the last time I had seen her was the first time I drank. And I felt so guilty that I never got to really get to know her because she was this incredible woman. And I lost her before I even had a chance. But I made it through that sober with the help of AA and my sober family and prayer, my higher power. I went through a deployment last year. I deployed, this time last year I was on deployment. And where I was not somewhere I could just get up and go to an AA meeting whenever I wanted. And it wasn't somewhere that I could just jump on the computer and find one. Besides, I tried that a couple times. And I'm really not a fan of online meetings. I don't know why. I just didn't like them. So I'd call people. I'd call my sponsor occasionally. And I'd call my wife or text people. And then I spent a lot of time in my big book and in prayer and in meditation. I work on an army boat. So we'd be out in the water and the stars out and it's dark. And you just go sit out on the back deck and the gentle sway of the boat. And I just meditate. And I learned a lot about myself during that time. And it's crazy. Every day I learn new stuff about myself and sobriety. Because I buried myself so deep in myself for so long that it takes a long time to dig it out. And I don't even have 3 years yet. So I'm sure there's plenty left for me to learn. There always will be. I will never know everything. It's something I learned in sobriety. Because I used to think I knew everything. We all did, I'm sure. We all think we know everything. We think we have the best answers for ourselves. And I was a terrible manager of myself. I wouldn't eat, I would just drink at some points. That's why I was 140 pounds and emaciated and thin and all that stuff. But I got sober and now I'm 170 pounds. Happily 170 pounds. And I'm sober and I'm happy and I have, A has given me so many gifts. Like I said, I can deal with emotions. Genuine happiness was something I hadn't felt in years. And the first time I felt it was amazing, and I never wanted to let go of it. And it's that one of those gifts that I hold on to, and I have to remind myself. Like every now and then, I'm like, you know, maybe this thing isn't. Maybe I'm not that bad. Maybe it wasn't that bad. And then a new memory. I remember something. I dug something up the other night, and I was like, oh no, I'm definitely an alcoholic. But I got that. I got a whole new family down here that I love. I got a wife that I adore, and her nephews and nieces that. Her nephew looks up to me as a role model. Don't know how that happened. I have no idea. But he does. And like, I feel responsible to be that for him if I can. So I stay in prayer and I stay with my, stay in these rooms. And I mean, I've worked the steps and a couple times and I just try and be of service to whoever I can be, whether they're in the rooms or out of the rooms. Because I don't think this AA is just for, it teaches us how to live a life, but not how to live life better and how to live life like a good person, not just a normal person, but a good person. It teaches us how to be there for people, not just if they're AA people or people in the rooms, but people in general. I find I can help people that are alcoholics as much as I can help somebody who's not an alcoholic. And that's a gift that was given me from this because I didn't used to care about anybody. I only cared about me. And now I try and be there for whoever I can be. And it helps me and it helps them. And it feels good to help somebody else. And I think I'm probably out of time. But that's yeah. I've never done this before, by the way. This is my first time speaking for the full time. I've done 15 minutes, but this is definitely a new animal. I was nervous as hell coming here. I had to meditate in the car on the way here because I was about to lose my shit. Heart's racing. And I'm like, I'm sitting in my car with my eyes closed. My wife's like, you need to like meditate or something. It's like, you need to do something. I'm like, yeah, you're probably right. I should probably do that. So I did, and it helped. I prayed, and I just, you know, that's one of the biggest things I find in sobriety is your higher power. You got to lean on that and draw from that. And like I pray to be truthful and honest and to be the mouthpiece. You know, this comes from my heart, but I ask that what I say be relevant and helpful to people because that is the goal. I mean, our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. So when I'm standing up here, yeah, it makes me feel better. It's good for my sobriety because I get to talk about myself a little bit. But really, it's for the newcomer or the person who's struggling out there. It's not for me. I'm not up here for me. I benefit from it, yeah. I mean, we benefit from a lot of stuff that we do for other people. And you wouldn't do it if you didn't benefit from it, right? But the primary purpose is always what I try and remember, is that I don't do this for me. I do this for the other alcoholic out there that's struggling. And I try and all of it. And that's why, part of the reason I love this program is because it's like, we look out for each other, and in turn, our fellows look out for us. That's really all I got. Thanks.
Let's see here. Thanks to both of you guys for sharing your stories.